Yes, it's Bigler's World. Oh, yeah, it's Bigler's World. And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. Got all kinds of kids' magazines all over the place here. Got a little bit of Nat Geo, National Geographic Kids. I'll start with that, but I also got some Science News Explorers. And what else? Time Magazine for kids? Yeah, it's time for kids. Let's do some outdoor sports quiz. Take this quiz to test your knowledge about sports played around the world. I'll do it. Okay, it says right here, with five, count them, five World Cup wins, which country has taken home this top soccer prize the most times? Has it been South Africa, Germany, Australia, or Brazil? I'm going with Brazil. It says correct. Brazil's the only country to win the World Cup five times. Next question. Professional soccer players run about how far during every game? 500 yards? I don't think so. 1,500 yards? 3 miles or 6 miles? I'm going to say 3 miles. This is wrong. Soccer players get a great workout. They run about 6 miles during a professional soccer match in their stocking feet. Next up. Now made of plastic and rubber, golf balls were once made of wood, clay, leather, or aluminum. I'm going to say leather, weren't they? Nope, they were made out of wood, it says. I'm not doing very well. A bump or mound of hard snow on a ski slope is known as a spike, a mogul, an igloo, or a glacier. This one was fairly easy. Even I could get it. Yes, the large mounds of snow you might find on ski slopes are called moguls. That's M-O-G-U-L-S, by the way. I didn't know that's how it was spelled. So there are only two sports that have been played on the moon. You've got golf and javelin throw, baseball and soccer, badminton and field hockey, or football and tennis. Well, there's the famous golf thing here. It says correct. Astronauts have played both golf and javelin throw after landing on the lunar surface. I didn't know about the javelin thing. Held every year since 1875, which is the longest continually run sports event in the U.S. Is it the Super Bowl, the U.S. Open, the Kentucky Derby, or the World Series? I'm going to go with Kentucky on that. It says correct. Kentucky Derby is the longest continually run event in the U.S. They didn't say how long. During the Wimbledon Championship in London, England, about how many tennis balls are used each year? Is it 5,000, 10,000, 43,000, or 54,000? I'm just going to take a shot at 43,000. It says wrong. 54,000 tennis balls are used each year during Wimbledon. That's probably too many, isn't it? Soccer, rugby, cricket, boxing, and golf were all invented in which country? Argentina, the United Kingdom, United States, or China? I'm going to go with the United Kingdom on that. It says correct. All of them, soccer, rugby, golf, cricket, boxing, were invented in the United Kingdom. Let's see. I got 5 out of 8 correct again. Correct, I felt really good about myself. Okay, next article. Sticking with National Geographic for kids. Women heroes. The women codebreakers of World War II. How more than 10,000 women worked with the U.S. military to help end the war. Written by Maya Wias. One chilly afternoon in November 1941, Anne White found an odd letter in her mailbox from an astronomy professor who wanted to meet. White, who was studying German at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, soon discovered that the professor had just two questions. Do you like crossword puzzles? And are you engaged to be married? The same two questions were asked of women across the United States. If the answer to the first was yes and the second no, the women were offered a chance to train for a secret career, breaking codes for the United States Army or Navy. Just 2 years before, Germany, ruled by the Nazi Party leader Adolf Hitler, had invaded Poland, making the start of World War II. That's what it says here. Tensions were still high following the end of World War I in 1918, and Hitler's invasion of Poland and other European countries led to a conflict that spread around the world. Countries generally split into sides. You got your Axis powers, whose major players included Germany, Italy, and Japan, and the Allies, which included Britain, France, Russia, China, and the United States. The United States ended the war on December 7th, 1941 after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor Naval Base on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. Many countries developed codes to send secret messages about things like upcoming battles or troop movements. Deciphering or breaking these codes let the Allies listen in on their enemies' plans and learn about battles before they even happened. As the United States prepared to send men into war, the country needed people to help with code breaking, and women, including Anne White, rose to the task. According to the book Code Girls by Liza Mundy, more than 10,000 women would serve for the U.S. Army and Navy, making up more than half the U.S. code breakers. Their hard-won efforts were key to winning the war. Loose lips sink ships. People have been sending and breaking secret messages for centuries. For example, George Washington led a group of spies who communicated with codes during the Revolutionary War. The invention of the radio allowed militaries during World War I to send secret messages faster than ever before and created more chances for others to listen in. In 1917, the U.S. Army created its first code and cipher bureau. A cipher is another way to make a message secret, which was later replaced with the Signal Intelligence Service. Soon after, the Navy created its own group that tracked communications between enemy ships and submarines. It was officially called OP, I don't know if that's OP 20G, but people who knew about it just called it the Research Desk. Although important, these code-breaking units were fairly small. As the military realized they might soon have to enter World War II, they slowly started to search for more code-breakers like Anne White. More than 300 Japanese planes swooped into the skies above Honolulu's Pearl Harbor in a surprise attack. The United States knew they had to do more to protect the country. That's when the military began a big push to find code breakers to make sure the country wouldn't be taken by surprise again. And with so many men headed to the battlefields, women were needed to fill these roles. At the time, most women did not have careers and instead got married and took care of their home, husband, and children. In fact, in the 1940s, only about 4% of U.S. women had completed 4 years of college. But the sudden need for codebreakers offered a new opportunity for college-educated women who claimed they weren't engaged or married. Employers back then figured that once a woman was married, she wouldn't have a paying job. Many women at U.S. colleges received letters similar to Anne White's. Others answered newspaper ads or signed up after meeting with military recruiters who traveled across the country looking for codebreakers. The women all went through difficult training courses to learn about deciphering coded messages. They promised to tell no one, even their families, what they were doing in case enemy countries were listening. As they were often reminded, loose lips sink ships. Searching for patterns. The women code breakers served many roles. They listened for coded radio messages from other countries. They collected things like the names of enemy ships and commanders that could be encoded in a coded message and therefore could help break it. They looked for patterns. For instance, where and when messages were sent could be clues about troop movements. They even tested American codes to make sure enemies couldn't break them. Teams that were often mostly women also broke codes and ciphers themselves, sometimes using complex technology and equipment to help. The codebreaker studied long strings of letters and numbers, looking for patterns that might reveal a message hidden in sentences that looked like nonsense. The work required a strong understanding of math, since many ciphers replaced letters and numbers, and then they hide the original message with equations. The codebreakers also needed a good memory, patience, and persistence. The women learned tricks such as looking for short phrases that sometimes marked the start of the coded notes, like begin message here. Pretty obvious. They would help them pry open the rest of the code, but the work was never easy. Throughout the war, the codes and ciphers changed, growing more and more complex, so each code needed to be cracked again and again. But codes weren't the only challenges the women faced. No. Even though the women codebreakers were doing the same work as men, they were paid less. Some of the military men treated the women poorly because they didn't think the women were important.
According to Mundy's book, one group of sailors ordered Navy women codebreakers to wash windows until a female officer stopped the task. The codebreakers took turns working around the clock, always aware their failures could mean that American troops might die. White recalled in Mundy's book, "Everyone we knew and loved was in that war." Ending the war. The codebreakers' work was crucial to winning the war, and women were an important part of every team. Genevieve Grotjen identified the key pattern that cracked the purple cipher, used to send messages to high-ranking Japanese government officials, which provided some of the most helpful information about their plans. Then you have Anne Karakristi. She helped crack a code that revealed the locations of Japanese supply ships so the American troops could sink them. Frances Steen was one of many women codebreakers who deciphered messages that helped the United States kill the Japanese Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Virginia D. Adderholt decoded the intercept message from the Japanese that they were about to surrender, which ended the war. Men often took credit for the women's accomplishments. For instance, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the first director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, claimed that his group broke up a Nazi spy ring in South America, but actually that win belonged to the codebreaker Elizabeth Smith Friedman, who helped decipher secret enemy messages during both world wars and is often called America's first female codebreaker. Without the women codebreakers, some experts believe that the war would have lasted 2 years longer than it did. But many were kicked out of the military after the war ended, and decades passed before they were recognized for their achievements. The women had promised to keep their work secret, and they stayed silent for years. During this time, many people thought that only men could be geniuses, while women were more fit for boring work that didn't take much thought. Although it took decades for the codebreakers' story to be told, their successes show just how brilliant women can be and how much can be achieved when everyone has a chance to shine. Okay, let's go to another publication here. On Bigler's World, still a little news for kids.net. It says right here, "World temperatures set records. Hottest January ever," is the title of this. It was incredibly cold across much of the U.S. last month, but scientists report that worldwide, it was the hottest January ever recorded. As heat records continue to be broken, some researchers believe that global warming could be speeding up. Not all scientists agree. And they got a little box here that says climate crisis. Since people first began burning coal to run factories, the world's temperature has been slowly rising. This increase has led to serious long-term changes in weather patterns that affect all life on Earth. The world is getting hotter, mainly because humans are burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, natural gas to make energy. These fuels give off pollution called greenhouse gases or carbon emissions, which make the climate emergency worse. The effects of climate change can already be seen. Melting ice in Antarctica and the Arctic, higher temperatures, heat waves, droughts, wildfires, record rains, and more strong hurricanes. Scientists say the world must take strong action before the year 2030 and limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Or is that centigrade? I think that's Celsius. To avoid the worst effects of climate crisis. They should have said Fahrenheit. I know what Fahrenheit is. Anyway, global warming is generally measured by comparing the world's current average temperature to the world's average temperature before people first began burning coal to run factories. In the 2015 Paris Agreement, countries of the world agreed to cut pollution in an effort to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Every bit of that planet heats up beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius will make life on Earth far more difficult. Researchers from the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service say the world's average temperature in January of 2025 was 1.75 degrees Celsius warmer than before humans began burning fossil fuels. January may have been cold in the U.S., but it was extremely the opposite in much of the rest of the world. In the Arctic, for example, some areas reached temperatures of 54 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than normal. This led to the second lowest level of Arctic sea ice ever recorded in January. Ocean temperatures matter too. Cooler waters can help reduce air temperatures. But over the last 2 years, sea surface temperatures have been extremely warm. January's sea temperatures were the second highest ever recorded. And it's not just a single month, no. 2024, with an average increase of 1.6 degrees Celsius, was the hottest year ever. Scientists report that global average temperatures have matched or broken the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit in 18 of the last 19 months. That sounds bad, and it is, but it doesn't mean that scientists believe the world has permanently reached the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. The world's temperature goes up and down. Scientists say that the limit won't be considered broken until temperatures remain over the limit for around 20 years. Still, the record heat of January has come as a surprise to many scientists. There are two important weather patterns that usually cause big temperature changes worldwide, El Niño and La Niña. The patterns are driven by changes in water temperature in the Pacific Ocean near the equator. El Niño years, like last year, are usually warmer, but temperatures usually drop quickly in La Niña years. A new La Niña weather pattern began in January of this year, but so far it hasn't cooled things down. That's what has scientists puzzled. James Hansen, he's a scientist who used to work for NASA, I got that right eventually, is well known as one of the first scientists to call attention to the problem of climate change. Dr. Hansen believes global warming may be speeding up. He says that in recent years, the rate of warming has nearly doubled. Other scientists suggest that this could just be an unusual period of warming and that it's too early to call it a pattern. But scientists agree that the warm temperatures are worrying and say the world must continue to work hard to cut fossil fuel use and to reduce the pollution that is heating the planet. Okay, let's do one more article from newsforkids.net. Bop-doop-bop-bump. It's entitled, Study Shows Birds of Paradise Give Off Light. Scientists have discovered that many species of birds of paradise have feathers that glow. Birds of paradise were already well known for their very colorful feathers and fancy dances they use to attract mates. The discovery suggests that the birds are even more striking than we knew. Birds of paradise live in the rainforests of Australia, New Guinea, and nearby islands. They are famous for their bright colors and strange and beautiful dances. Male birds of paradise dance and show off their colors to attract female birds. But, until recently, no one knew that the birds also glowed. The scientific word for this glowing is biofluorescence. That's different from bioluminescence, which is when an animal produces its own light, as fireflies do. Biofluorescence is when animals take in one kind of light and give off another kind. Scientists have found biofluorescence in many different animals, including fish, frogs, and even some mammals, including bats. But no one knew much about biofluorescence in birds of paradise. Dr. Renee Martin decided to take a look into it. The American Museum of Natural History has samples of male and females from 45 different species of birds of paradise. Dr. Martin and her team tested these samples in a dark room. They did this by shining UV light and blue light on the birds and using special tools to carefully measure the light that came off of them. They found strong biofluorescence in 37 out of 45 species of birds of paradise. Is this Dr. Martin talking? Yes, it is. She says, it's kind of a bright green and green-yellow color. The glowing was strongest in males, which showed biofluorescence, especially in areas displayed in mating dances, the head, neck, stomach, and tail feathers. The biofluorescence was also found on their faces and inside their mouths. Birds of paradise often open their mouths wide during mating dances. The scientists found that female birds of paradise also had some biofluorescence, but not nearly as much as the males. Dr. Martin thinks it's possible that females use their biofluorescence to blend in better with the rainforest around them. Biofluorescence isn't the only trick male birds of paradise use to make themselves stand out. Previously, other researchers discovered that the feathers of some species of birds of paradise aren't just black, they are ultra black. These dark feathers absorb almost all the light that hits them, making the birds' bright colors stand out even more. Since birds of paradise are famous for their colorful displays, it's perhaps not surprising that they also have biofluorescence. Dr. Martin says the glow may help make the males brighter and more eye-catching. Females are picky about their mates, and the glowing colors may help them pick a good one. But scientists say more research is needed to figure out exactly how the birds use the glowing colors. The scientists were studying samples of the birds in museum. Seeing living birds in natural light in their own habitats would probably give researchers much more information. But carrying on a careful science experiment under these conditions would also be a major challenge. And at the very bottom it says, Did you know? Scientists believe that birds of paradise got their biofluorescence from an ancestor a long, long time ago. They think these six species that no longer have biofluorescence must have lost that ability at some point in the past. Okay, let's go to some science news explores. This article entitled, This Computer Scientist Uses Math to Help People Be Treated Fairly. Ariel Procaccia designs algorithms to split up chores, distribute donations, and more. Maria Temming wrote this article. Ariel Procaccia has always been fascinated by big questions and hard problems. As a teenager, one of his favorite books was Fermat's Last Theorem. It tells the tale of how a single math puzzle stumped the world's greatest minds for more than 300 years. Another favorite was A Brief History of Time. That book explores deep questions about the universe. By the time he went to college, Procaccia knew he wanted to study two of three things, math, computer science, and physics. But he says, "But my dad is a physics professor, and it seemed weird to do the same thing he did," Procaccia says. "So I chose the other two." Today, Procaccia is a computer scientist at Harvard University, Harvard, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There he designs computer algorithms that solve problems quickly and fairly. Through this work, Procaccia has been able to tackle some big problems that directly affect people's daily lives. "I worked on challenges like where to resettle refugees so that they are most likely to succeed, how to allocate food donations to organizations that need them, and how to design new forms of democracy," he says. "I'm especially interested in problems whose solutions have a tangible impact on our society." Let's see here. They asked him, "What project are you most proud of and why?" "Well, one of my favorite projects is splitit.org. It's a free website that helps people divide stuff in a way that mathematically guarantees fairness. For one example, one of the apps on Splitit, that's SPLIDDIT, is rent division. Say a few roommates rent an apartment and have different preferences over rooms. The goal is to assign the rooms and divide the rent in a way that each roommate feels they got the best deal. Amazingly, you can prove that this is always possible. Since Splendid's launch back in 2014, it has been used by hundreds of thousands of people." What are you most excited to be working on right now? "I'm especially excited about our work on fair algorithms for selecting citizens' assemblies. These assemblies are tasked with discussing important issues. They also make recommendations for policymakers. They're made up of people who are randomly selected from volunteers, but the random selection is done in a way that leads to an assembly that looks like the overall population. For example, there's usually a similar number of men and women. At the same time, every volunteer has to have a fair chance of participating in the assembly. we developed an algorithm that balances these different needs, and it's been used widely around the world. What do you find most rewarding about your work? Well, in my job as a professor, I get to work closely with amazing graduate students. Over a typical 5-year PhD, a very special lifelong bond is formed. Professors and their students often speak of each other as academic children and academic parents. And as someone who has 3 actual children, I think there's a lot of truth to that. In particular, when my students succeed and achieve their goals, it makes me very proud. Any advice for future computer scientists? Well, this advice is not for those who aspire to be computer scientists, but for those who don't. Computer scientist Edgar Dijkstra, he famously said that computer science is no more about computers than astronomy is about telescopes. I don't know if I would go that far, but I think that a lot of computer science is based about how you solve problems in the best possible way. And with that toolbox, you can tackle almost any challenge. So even if you believe computers aren't your cup of tea, computer science might be. Okay, let's do one more article here from Science News Explorers. This is entitled, this article, High-Speed Lasers Write Data to Last Millennia Inside Glass. The data might outlast humanity, leaving messages for future civilizations or even aliens. Whichever comes first. Catherine Hulick wrote this article. A robot whirs, yes, I said whirs, along a library shelf. Instead of books, this shelf holds napkin-sized squares of flat, clear glass. The robot selects a piece of glass and brings it over to a microscope. The instrument peers deep inside the glass. A speckly pattern, invisible to the naked eye, now comes into focus. A high-speed laser etched this pattern, and a computer can now read the digital information stored within it. Each piece of glass is like a book, after all, a futuristic one. Each slim plate can hold 7 terabytes of data. That's as much information as 2 million books typically hold today. The library, robot, laser, microscope, and platters of glass are all part of a research program named Project Silica. Let's see, Richard Black, he directs this project at Microsoft Research in Cambridge, England. And is this him talking? Yes, he says, Project Silica is a new approach to storing data, he says. The latest computer hard drives easily hold terabytes worth of data, but those drives last only around 3 to 5 years. In fact, all of today's common methods of storing digital data tend to wear out quickly, Black notes. Every few years, you've got to buy a new storage medium and copy. And then over and over again, buy and copy, buy and copy. The speckly data inside the glass, though, can last for thousands of years, Black says, or perhaps even longer. It's a very neat and clever idea. Oh, this is somebody else named Deep Jerwala, who did not take part in this project. An electrical engineer, he works at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Glass is actually quite durable. This is Black again. These platters can withstand all sorts of calamities. You could leave the glass platter in boiling water, says Black. You can put it in the oven. You can microwave it. You could even scratch the surface without marring the data inside it. Or you could jettison the glass platter into space, carrying a message to aliens. That's exactly what an international team of high school students plans to do. In a podcast last fall, Microsoft Research announced its support for this project called Golden Record 2.0. How to write inside glass. It was this John Lomberg. He's an artist based in Kona, Hawaii. He says, it's fun to think about talking to aliens. But those glass patterns may soon have important uses here on Earth. People create and use a staggering amount of information. There are medical data, scientific experiments, banking records, Hollywood movies, and so much more. A lot of this information, says Black, needs to be kept for a long time period. There's huge quantities of it, and it's pouring in every day. Back in 2014, researchers at the University of Southampton, England, used lasers to record data inside glass for the first time. At that time, says Jingju Zhang, we were very happy. Jingju Zhang was part of the team. He's now a physicist at Wazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan, China. The laser pulses are so rapid that they are measured in femtoseconds. One femtosecond is 1,000th of 1,000,000th of 1,000,000th of a second, Black explains. Taking even a small amount of energy and focusing it in on a tiny point, such a teensy amount of time, has surprising results. The intensity at that point is just so mind-boggling, he says. You get something called a plasma nano explosion. This explosion creates a very tiny divot in the surface of the glass. Engineers call it a voxel. Voxel formation is predictable. Whenever you fire the laser the same way, the voxel forms the same way, Zhang explains. So different types of voxels can act like ones and zeros to represent digital data. These voxels can also be layered on top of each other inside a sheet of glass. When you want to read the data, you use a microscope. It focuses on a small area of just one layer inside the glass. A camera records the pattern of voxels there. In the decades since the discovery by Zhang's team, Microsoft has been improving the technology. They've found ways to write and read voxels faster and more reliably. They also now use machine learning, a type of AI, to convert voxel patterns into digital data. Plus, they've built a library of these stored sheets of data. It features robots called shuttles that shelve and retrieve glass platters. So far, a robot has never yet dropped a platter, but if a platter broke or got lost, Black says, its data can always be found spread across many other platters. This is a common technique used when storing data on all kinds of media. For now, this is the only library of its kind, but Black has big goals. Microsoft runs hundreds of data centers.
The goal, Black says, would be eventually a library like this in every data center.
For data that we want to work with or access regularly, we still need regular hard drives. That's because voxel patterns can't be altered once they're written, says Jarwala.
This is an archival form of data storage.
It's meant to last a long time, unchanged. That's why it's such a perfect technology for the Golden Record Project. And being unchangeable makes the stored data especially hack-proof, Black adds. That's in sharp contrast to the magnetic tape used in past long-term storage methods. Tape can be rewritten as it's being read. A message for humanity. A new golden record that's being aimed at aliens is not the first of its kind. No. Back in the 1970s, NASA launched two Voyager spacecraft. Their main goal was to explore the solar system and beyond. Each one also carried a 30-centimeter, or 12-inch, gold-plated copper disc. The disc contained a message about humanity. John Lumberg selected many images and much of the music stored on the records. Such a disc like this is, he says, a message in a bottle thrown into an ocean. These spacecraft are still out there flying through the depths of space. If aliens ever find one, they'll be able to learn about who built it. However, those records used a very early type of data storage. Not much fit onto the disc. Plus, humanity has changed a lot in the decades since. Elisa Zhang and No Matthew are working on the message for the new record. Both are juniors at Avenues the World School in New York City.
Ours is more of a modern version of the original, says Alicia.
Students at schools in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and San Jose, California, are also involved in the project. Lomberg is advising all of these students, but this time around, he's not choosing what to put into the message. I've had my chance to say what pictures should go and what music should go, he says. He hopes lots of young people will contribute to the new message. You can send in pictures or other suggested content to the Golden Record 2.0 website, says Alicia. It can be photos of family. It can be pets. Pictures showing different cultures from around the world are also important. No points out that they are also looking for audio, including greetings, in other languages.
We have to think about how to represent humanity as a whole, No says.
The students haven't yet found a spacecraft to carry the message, but they aren't rushing. They want to take time to perfect the message first, says Lomberg. A time capsule. We don't know yet if life even exists beyond Earth, and the universe is a vast, mostly empty space. So chances are slim that another being will ever find one of these messages, either the older metal versions or their new ones made of glass. However, even if the messages never get found, Lomberg and the students he's working with think their efforts are worthwhile.
The fact that the golden records will be there long after humans are gone, perhaps long after the planet itself is gone, is awe-inspiring and thrilling, says Lomberg.
Alicia says, it's not only an archive of humanity for aliens, it's also an archive for us. Dexter Green worked on the project with Alicia and No until he graduated last spring. He's currently studying mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
I like to think of it as a time capsule of humanity, he said in a podcast. It's about showing who we are to ourselves, like taking a step back to realize who we are, how far we've come, which direction we should go.
Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World. That's right. Let's do a little scout life. It's Scout Life. First article we got here, See You at Camp. Who wrote this? Michael Freeman. Ready to have some fun this summer? It asks right off the bat. These incredible camps have got you covered. Camp Alexander Pathway to the Rockies. Well, that's all the same thing. Located in Lake George, Colorado, mountains are calling. This 325-acre mountain camp sits at more than 8,000 feet in elevation and boasts, there's plural, views of evergreen forests, rugged cliffs, and nearby mountains, including Pikes Peak. You even get a scenic view or two of waterfalls as you enter camp. It also features access to a lake and a river where you can fish for rainbow trout. Into the outback. Older scouts can embark on a rocky mountain adventure, both on and off site. In the Outback program, you get to pedal a mountain bike around the canyon in camp, ride the whitewater rapids on the Arkansas River, and scale rock walls in Red Rocks Canyon. You'll hike up mountains to, oh yes, Blue Mountain in camp, and the 14,115-foot-tall Pikes Peak. Theme of the day, every day is different. It might be Crazy Hat Day or Hawaiian Shirt Day. The camp's high-energy staff keeps fun at the forefront. They lead camp songs and offer 45 merit badge classes and host a carnival day when scouts can play games and savor. Yes, they savor hamburgers and snow cones. Not necessarily at the same time. Then there's Camp Squanto Mayflower, council location, Plymouth, Massachusetts. See, a century of camp. Step back in time by visiting the Cassoni Museum. You can check out old troop photos, camp patches, and a scouting theme model train set. It's a great place to work on the scouting heritage and railroading merit badges, two of the 60 merit badges normally offered at this 100-year-old camp. Head off-site. There are plenty of fun activities at camp, sunfish sailing, archery, and a COPE ropes course. If you're an experienced camper and want to try something different off-site, sign up for the ACE program,
where you can go whale watching at Plymouth Harbor, kayak at a nearby lake, and climb at an indoor gym. All at the exact same time. Put on your game face. Don't laugh when you're face-to-face with a staff member as they're mooing like a cow. Getting to a moo-off challenge is just one of these silly, fun games you can play. You can also enjoy human foosball, gaga ball, three-legged relay races, cornhole, and water polo. Some events are live-streamed. Let's see, on what is this? Goose Pond Scout Reservation. I'm not sure if this, I printed this up and now it's doing weird things. It says Goose Pond Scout Reservation. Is that the next one here? Northeastern Pennsylvania Scout location. There it is, Lake Ariel, Pennsylvania. Talk to me, Goose. Okay, they threw that in there. Founded in 1920, this camp has more than 500 acres to enjoy, but only 200 scouts are on site each week. This creates a family-style atmosphere where staff members get to know you by name by the end of the week. Whether you're working on rank requirements in the first-year program or taking one of the 50 merit badge classes or going outpost camping in the Voyager program. Rich in history, famous scouter Bill Hillcourt, nicknamed Green Bar Bill, visited Goose Pond to honor the author of the first field book and multiple editions of the Boy Scout Handbook. The camp offers Green Bar Patrol Awards. Build patrol spirit through the week, and you might help your unit earn a special honor ribbon. Too much to do. If there's one complaint staff hears, it's that there's too much to do in a single week. You can drive all-terrain vehicles or ATVs, go whitewater canoeing down the Delaware River, sail on the 45-acre lake, or ride a 300-foot-long zip line. Because there's so much, you'll want to go back next year to do everything else. Then there's Camp Constantin. I'm going to say Constantin. Circle 10 Council location, Grafford, Texas. A week by canoe. Interested in earning the 50-miler award, the Exploration Merit Badge, and Snorkeling Award? You can get the ball during a week-long aquatic trek. Fun on the lake. Everyone can take part in a raft race, a sailing regatta, and a Grand Olympiad, which is a troop relay race requiring running, swimming, and canoeing. You can take several water-based merit badges out of the camp's 60-plus badges typically offered. In your free time, Camp Constantin provides plenty of fun activities, from movie nights to video game tournaments to gaga ball and a paintball range, plus disc golf and sand volleyball. You can go hiking, play chess, and add branding, there it is, to some of your gear. There are soccer games throughout the week, too. And there's Camp Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett. Out of the wild frontier. Okay, here's this one. Sequoia Council location. That's Whitesburg, Tennessee, on the wild frontier. Spend a week at Davy Crockett's Frontier Camp, where you can enjoy blacksmithing and leather working. You get to take home a time period hunting shirt. Is that right? That you'll wear during the special camp program that takes you back to the 1800s. Let's play. You can climb the 72-foot wall climbing tower, take a dip in the huge swimming pool, golf the 9-hole course, kayak the lake, take on the archery range, and play basketball and card games. You can challenge the camp's staff to a game, too. Once a troop and the staff held a contest requiring them to wrestle in inflatable alligator. To wrestle an inflatable alligator. The staff also hosts a podcast that highlights skits and games. A scout is reverent. Being out in nature can also be a time to reflect on your life and faith. The camp offers a religious program for a variety of beliefs, allowing you to delve deeper into the 12th point of scout law. There's a set of patches you can earn as you work on projects and essays. Then they have Tomahawk Scout Camp, North Star Council location, Birchwood, Wisconsin, waterlogged. Head over to the waterfront for aquatic fun. There's a 35-foot giant blob and other inflatables to bounce on, as well as a rope swing and games. You can learn how to navigate a catamaran sailboat and go board sailing on the lake. Older scouts can sign up for a sailing adventure on Lake Superior aboard a 60-foot boat or go on a whitewater kayaking or canoeing trip. Become a lumberjack and become okay. Learn how to chop wood and climb poles at the Knapstout Logging Camp. Make a miniature tomahawk, use a two-person saw, and brand a mug, water bottle, or wooden cookie to take home. Older scouts can also work on building a log cabin and try blacksmithing. Back to nature. Horseback rides are available in the afternoons and evenings, but the horses aren't the only animals at Tomahawk. No, no, no. You can visit the fields northeast of the Welcome Center, home to a herd of more than 100 bison. You can also learn about beavers, reptiles, and amphibians on site. Okay, the next one here is Quivira Scout Ranch. Quivira Council location in Seddon, Texas, whatever it is, all that's fit to print. I don't know what that's about. Many camps have technology centers where you can learn about STEM and digital tech. At Quivira's center, you can use one of the four 3D printers to design and make amazing creations. Scouts have printed chess sets, mugs, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson figurines. Rockin' and reelin'. Activities abound, include rock climbing at both an artificial climbing area and a natural rock wall. The 3,000-acre property also has a large lake, a target sports area, hiking and biking trails, and a fish camp where local game wardens and biologists teach lessons about the fish in the lake and where you practice fishing for them. High Q. Want some high adventure? Quivira's got you covered with its new high adventure program, High Q. Choose from 3 week-long adventures, fish, F-I-S-H, camp, conquer the water, or backpacking at fish camp. You'll learn everything you need to know about the fish in the lake and how to catch them. Are they repeating themselves here? For conquer the water, it's a week on the water as you hop in a canoe, kayak, jet ski, or dragon boat. And in backpacking, trek to a 2-night outpost where you can go hiking and canoeing. And they have Camp Pioneer, Cascade Pacific Council location in, if I can read any of these, Idenha, Oregon, a classic camp. The Cascade Pacific Council has 3 camps. You got your Meriwether, Baldwin, and Pioneer. If you want to go to a big camp with lots of amenities, check out Meriwether. If you want to go horseback riding, Baldwin is the place to be. But if you want a classic summer camp experience in a serene location where you can receive individualized attention, then Pioneer is for you. Get out. Every Wednesday, you can get out of camp for a fun day trip, hike around the lush green forests of the Mount Jefferson Wilderness area, or scramble along a mountain trail. You can also go spelunking at one of the coolest nearby attractions, the Sawyer Ice Caves, which hold ice formations as late as July. All about the merch. The design for the camp's t-shirts, hoodies, and snapback caps changes every year. You'll want to update your wardrobe with all the cool gear, each emblazoned with the camp's signature gem logo. Okay. Next up here on Bigler's World, sticking with scout life, spring into classes. Who wrote this? Stephen Kent. 2 legends have returned. They're bigger, better, and bolder than ever. When your grandparents played Donkey Kong games, the giant ape was a bad guy who mostly threw wooden barrels. When your parents played them, Donkey and his nephew Diddy battled an evil tribe of crocs that had stolen his bananas. How dare they? Well, he's back, and back where he belongs, battling the Tiki Tok tribe. He is still safeguarding the stash of bananas. He still has barrels, but now he can fly them as he and Diddy brave, is that right? Diddy brave another fast-paced, challenging, two-dimensional, side-scrolling adventure. Then there's Sid Meier's Civilization 7. Let's see, 2X games for Mac OS, Linux, PS4, PS5, Switch, Xbox One, and Xbox Series X. Let's see, Sid Meier's Civilization series introduced 34 years ago on computers so primitive they might have used steam engines, interwove detailed history with a turn-based strategy. I'm not sure what that means. What if the Roman Empire had survived today? What if the United States and Pharaoh's Egypt somehow became the world's superpowers? Civilization games aren't just mindless wars. They involve economic, technological, and political development. All Civilization games have been fun, but powered by new technology, they've also become beautiful to watch. Let's see what we've got here. Private Division and Take-Two Interactive 4, PS5, Switch, Xbox Series X, and Steam, whatever Steam is. Hobbit games have been mostly about combat and adventures, but Tales of the Shire is a life simulation. Picture Animal Crossing comes to the Middle Earth. It's about farming, fishing, and making friends. Players can also cook, clean, and throw parties without worrying about the wraiths of Mordor knocking on their door or a Balrog hiding in their closet. Let's see, Gamer Gab. The first Donkey Kong came out in 1981. Here is how Nintendo's giant ape has changed over the years. 1981, Donkey Kong debuted in the arcade game Donkey Kong. Cleverly named. 1982, a distinctly primitive Donkey Kong appears on Game and Watch. That's a handheld gaming device, or was back in 82. 1994 to present, Donkey Kong's personality has evolved during this time. He's no longer a mindless villain, but a more lovable heroic figure fighting to protect his home, the jungle, and his friends. And what's the next one here? Captains of the Outfield. Oh, that's an entirely new article. Okay, that's the third article I got here. Hope I have time to read it. Captains of the Outfield, published right here in Scout Life. Joel Poiley wrote this here. Meet some baseball's best center fielders. Well, I will. Center fielders are the baseball stars making the highlight reel plays, leaping to rob home runs or sliding across the outfield to prevent base hits. They cover vast territory and lead the defense by taking charge of pop-ups and directing teammates. These players have powerful, accurate arms to keep runners from advancing and are critical offensive contributors, often hitting home runs and driving in key runs. Veterans like Aaron Judge and Mike Trout have long set the standard as top center fielders, but rising stars like Julio Rodriguez and Luis Robert Jr. are the next big names. These players embody the athleticism, leadership, and offensive power that define the best center fielders in Major League Baseball. Aaron Judge, New York Yankees. Any discussion about Judge centers on his incredible offensive production. In his ninth season in 2024, he put up huge numbers with 58 home runs, 144 runs batted in, and a .322 batting average, leading the Yankees to the American League, or AL, East title. Last August, he surpassed 300 career home runs, becoming the fastest player to reach that milestone in Major League history. Judge has hit 50-plus homers in three different seasons, a feat accomplished by only four other players. Let's see, despite his towering 284-pound, 6'7" frame, Judge covers significant ground in the outfield. Initially a right fielder when he joined the Yankees back in 2016, he transitioned to center field in 2022. Is this him talking? I think it is.
I've always felt like I'm the center fielder.
He said that in a 2022 New York Post article.
Even when they keep putting me in right field, I always treat everything like I'm the center fielder.
Judge is also dedicated to his defense, learning how the ball bounces off the outfield wall and warning track and the grass, and how ground balls move at every stadium. Mike Trout, Los Angeles Angels. When healthy, Trout consistently ranks among baseball's best center fielders offensively and defensively. From 2012 to 2019, he was widely regarded as the top player, winning the AL Most Valuable Player Awards and the AL Rookie of the Year Award, and 7 Silver Slugger Awards, and making the All-Star team each year. However, he missed significant playing time with injuries in 2017 and the 2021 to 24 seasons. Despite injury setbacks, Trout is still a Hall of Famer caliber player. I think it was a Hall of Fame caliber player as he enters his 15th season. In 2022, he played 119 games and contributed to 28 doubles, 40 home runs, and 80 RBIs, numbers that would be impressive even in a full 162-game season. Trout has hit more than 30 home runs in 7 seasons and driven in more than 100 runs 3 times. His combination of power and speed dazzles at the plate and in the field. I don't think I'm going to be able to get through this here. Julio Rodriguez, Seattle Mariners. He burst onto the scene at age 21 back in 2022, winning the AL Rookie of the Year Award with 28 home runs, 25 stolen bases, 75 RBIs, and a .284 average. He followed up with an even more impressive second season. He became the first player ever to hit 25 home runs and steal 25 bases in each of his first 2 seasons, and the third notch 30-plus home runs, 30-plus stolen bases, and 100 RBIs by the age of 22 or younger. Combined with his speed, covering ground in the outfield, and powerful throwing arm, he has quickly established himself as one of the game's elite players. Then there's Lewis Robert Jr., Chicago White Sox. He's a powerful and speedy baseball player at 6'2", 230 pounds. In 2023, during his 4th season, he achieved a rare combination with 36 doubles, 38 homers, a franchise record for the White Sox center fielders, 20 steals, and 80 RBIs. He earned his first All-Star game appearance that year. More so, Robert's power lets him easily hit pitches to all parts of the field, and his exceptional speed helps him make impressive defensive plays, including diving catches and robbing opponents at the fence. His performance dipped last year due to team struggles and a hip injury, but at age 27, he's expected to bounce back this season. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.